While the importance of optimizing a woman's hemoglobin level during the peripartum period has been emphasized by several guidelines, like those by the Society of Obstetric Anesthesia and Perinatology, the Enhanced Recovery After Surgery Society, and of course, ACOG, postpartum anemia remains a real issue in both the developed and developing world. Postpartum anemia has been associated with postpartum depression, fatigue, impaired lactation, and impaired cognition. This may lead to impaired maternal-child bonding. Plus, severe anemia during pregnancy has been identified as an important predictive factor for postpartum hemorrhage, which, ironically and unfortunately, further aggravates the problem. This relationship has been published in a meta-analysis in 2021, calling attention to the importance of correcting anemia in the antepartum period. Packed red blood cell transfusion is typically recommended for women with postpartum hemoglobin levels less than 6 grams per deciliter or between 7 and 9 grams per deciliter when it's accompanied by symptoms of anemia. However, in the absence of active bleeding or symptoms, limited transfusion is recommended, and this is where IV iron comes in that 7 to 9 gram per deciliter range. Is pre-medication needed prior to IV iron? What about pre-medication before giving blood? What's the difference between a Fishbane reaction and a true hypersensitivity issue? We're going to cover all of these issues, plus the benefits of postpartum IV iron, typical protocols, and of course, we're going to give some clinical pearls in this episode. Just trying to keep everyone up to date on evidence-based practice because medicine moves real fast. This is Clinical Pearls. Yeah, we've covered oral iron and IV iron supplementation mainly during antepartum intervals in the past. Actually, I just sent that link to one of our podcast family members. It was back in 2019. So since it's 2024, I thought, yeah, I guess we could talk about this issue on the postpartum side. So this is how this came about, because over this weekend, somebody messaged me and said, hey, postpartum IV iron versus oral iron, what's the deal with that? I mean, that's not exactly what the message was, but you understand my paraphrasing. So it is true, right? Because look, in postpartum anemia, we really have three camps. Oh my gosh, you had severe postpartum hemorrhage. You're totally decompensating. Or your hemoglobin is like 5, so typically under 6. You're like, you just need blood. I mean, that's a part of basic physiology so that oxygen can get to your renal tubules and to your brain and your heart. I mean, you just need iron. You just need iron support. You need blood. So under 6, typically that's you just kind of need blood. I mean, from a physiologic perspective, you just need homeostasis to function. And people are like, well, she's asymptomatic. She's in bed. Her pulse is, 95. Yeah, well, she's lying down. As soon as she gets up, her hemoglobin of 5 is going to declare itself. So yes, there is an absolute, which is basically under 6. I mean, damn, you just need some blood back for typical physiologic function. And of course, over 9 in the postpartum state, even though that is legit anemia, because ACOG says, remember, in the third trimester, anemia is anything less than 11 grams per deciliter in general. So it's anemic, but no one's going to give blood for a hemoglobin of 9 unless something else is going on. There's still persistent bleeding. She's obviously tachycardic, which would be weird because hemoglobin of 9 isn't that bad unless, guys, here it is, it's not yet equilibrated, all right? That's why you always treat the patient clinically, not just the lab value. Lab value is ancillary. That's why ACOG's definition of postpartum hemorrhage is 1,000 mLs of blood loss, regardless of mode of delivery, within the first 24 hours, or any blood loss with signs or symptoms of hypovolemia, tachycardia, with hypotension, syncope in the appropriate clinical context, okay? So there is the definitive diagnosis based on amount of blood lost, and then the definition of postpartum hemorrhage, not necessarily by volume lost, but by clinical symptoms, okay, signs and symptoms, okay? Because we don't want to miss anybody. So those are the two different boxes of definition of postpartum hemorrhage. So under six, most people understand, hey, you just kind of need blood back, and that's blood. That's not IV iron. That's blood products. That's just for normal functioning before somebody's released from the hospital. Over nine, you're like, and in general, that should be okay. That's where oral supplementation can have a role. The question is, in the patient who's not actively bleeding and is asymptomatic, what to do with those patients that have a hemoglobin value postpartum of around seven, seven and eight, all right? So remember, less than six, we know what to do with that. Over nine, it's anemic, but they should be okay as long as they have every other day oral iron supplementation, and they understand the importance of that, and not with milk. It ideally should be with a vitamin C or an acidic environment to allow for absorption. We've covered non-daily oral iron supplementation in the past because that's a great way to have it not work because you saturate the hepcidin receptors. So remember that it should be every other day, okay? Same thing for IV iron, by the way. It should be given every other day until the total milligrams of iron that's lost has been repleted, okay? So the idea is what do we do here in that catch? Hey, she's asymptomatic, no longer bleeding, and we checked her hemoglobin ideally in the correct time, because we all do that, right? Oh, I think she was on that borderline of postpartum hemorrhage. It was like 900 mLs. She's not tacky now. Her vitals are good. Let's check her crit in 4 hours. Why? Well, why do we do that? That's all tradition. That hemoglobin or hematocrit hasn't equilibrated. It takes at least 24, and based on other studies, 36 hours to really have that level solidify and become baseline, okay, to become steady. So the only real value of checking a hemoglobin or a hematocrit quickly after a PPH is because if that's low, and assuming it wasn't drawn over an active IV line, then it's really bad, okay? Because typically that's not where it's going to end up. So if you draw it 4 hours after a suspected PPH and the hemoglobin is seven, oh man, I mean, that's going to get even worse, because that's definitely not at its lowest point, at its nadir, because it takes time to do that. So, I'm not against checking H&H quickly. Just realize that if it's good, that's likely not where she's going to end up. So the interpretation of that is, okay, well, right now it's good. It hasn't really equilibrated, so we will continue to follow and then transfuse based on symptomatology or signs or symptoms that are concerning, like tachycardia, hypotension, or decreased urine output, okay? So if it's good, doesn't mean you're done. If it's bad early, then it's pretty bad, because it takes at least 24 up to 36 hours based on who you read for that iron after a bleeding event to really equilibrate, okay? That's why ACOG states you don't base in an active bleeding scenario, like 1.5 liters or more, and this is all in ACOG's postpartum hemorrhage data. If you have persistent bleeding at 1.5 liters, you need to give some blood, because that's going to dip into the iron stores already. That's going to get acute blood loss anemia. This is an ACOG's practice bulletin number 183. And notice it doesn't say unless the hemoglobin is okay. No, forget that, because it's going to take time to equilibrate. So in this practice bulletin, it states, quote, in women with ongoing bleeding that equates to a blood loss of 1,500 mLs or more, or in women with abnormal vital signs, immediate preparation for transfusion should be made, end quote. All right, so we get that. And in the same practice bulletin, by the way, it says, oh, historically, we chose the value of seven and under to kind of give blood products, but now really it's shared decision-making between oral iron every other day, IV iron while still in the hospital, or blood products based on the clinical situation, okay? So I just want to make that distinction. The practice bulletin states that traditionally it was seven or under. Now that's kind of moved down a little bit, right? So now it's six or under. You just pretty much need blood. That's just for, again, homeostasis and good physiological functioning. But between seven and eight, that's that zone where IV iron should have a role. Now, for sure, I mean, at the bottom recommendation, at the least, it's still the patient, you got to take your iron every other day. Now, remember, there's a newborn, she's tired, she's going to be lactating, she just took vitamins all throughout the pregnancy. I'm not saying that it's not going to happen, that they're not going to do it. I'm just saying they got other things on their mind. This is where the value of IV iron comes into play. So that's going to be the focus of this episode. Even though we're going to talk about typical protocols, we're going to talk about what the Fishbane reaction is as opposed to a true hypersensitivity / anaphylactic reaction. We're going to talk about why giving Benadryl or an antihistamine or Tylenol before iron is really not needed, even though that's how I trained. That was a thing. And that's not a thing either, spoiler, for blood products, that's how I trained. I mean, that was a typical Parkland protocol. She needs to get some packed red blood cells, give her 25 or 50 milligrams Benadryl IM or IV, and then 1 gram of Tylenol. And that was to really try to cut down on some of the normal response of the body to receiving blood, because there's some proteins in the blood that kind of make a little a reaction in the body. These are non-hemolytic reactions, okay? I'm not talking about, you know, they're having Coca-Cola urine and their kidneys are shutting down and they can't breathe. That's different. But if you give people blood, then typical response is a little bit of pyrexia. Their temperature can go up a little bit. They can have chills, sometimes a little bit of itching. Those are all normal responses. Those are mini allergic responses to blood products, blood proteins that are being transfused. But those are not hemolytic reactions. Okay, so we have to make that distinction. So historically, it was just prep her with Benadryl and Tylenol, and then give her blood. Probably unnecessary. That's according to the data. And just like pre-medication, spoiler, is not needed for blood products, which we're going to talk about here in a minute. I'm going to give you that data. Pre-medication is not needed before IV iron. Okay. So the idea was, well, if we're going to give them iron of some type, whether it's iron sucrose, iron dextran, which kind of isn't used anymore, or a maltose-based derivative, let's get them some Benadryl first so they can prevent them from having a flare or some kind of response, and Tylenol. Not necessary. Plus, remember, if somebody has an anaphylactic reaction, guys, let's stop here for a minute. If somebody has an anaphylactic reaction, right? So somebody has a peanut allergy and, oh my gosh, they take a bite of some sandwich and it's got full of peanuts and they go to starting to have true anaphylaxis or a bee sting, whatever. You don't go say, oh my gosh, give me some Benadryl. That's not going to help. That's going to help them stop itching. That's not going to fix the allergic response. How do we all break, everyone? Here's a clinical pearl. Get your medical students on rounds. This is a great, they're going to fall into this hole all the time, because at least 50% of people not thinking on the fly correctly will say, oh, that's a Benadryl issue. No, they need epi. They need rescuing. They need epinephrine. They need adrenaline to counter the histamine flare, okay? Benadryl is great as a secondary intervention to help with the bothersome itching and the rashes that you get. But the only thing that fixes a life-threatening allergic reaction, in other words, anaphylaxis, is IV fluids, airway support, and epinephrine. So here's a spoiler. And guys, this is new again to me within the last several years, because I'm guilty of this. When IV iron started getting kind of sexy for postpartum use, and we're going to talk about it here because it does have value, and it seems to have better value than oral iron because you don't have the constipation and the compliance issue, and it just works at the trade-off of potentially higher cost. We get that. But the value there for decreased fatigue, for increased iron stores, both in ferritin and hemoglobin levels, is very well documented. This has now been very well published in the data that IV iron doesn't just work antepartum when indicated, but it also works postpartum. There seems to be a superiority there to oral iron, okay? Because you avoid some of the issues with oral iron, mainly compliance and the other things like side effects. So am I a fan of IV iron postpartum? Absolutely. But it's not for everybody. I'm not going to give it to somebody with a hemoglobin of 9.5 just because it's under the 11 grams per deciliter that's supposed to be in the third trimester because they just plopped out a kid. So whether it's C-section or vaginal, I mean, damn. I mean, have some common sense to go, hey, look, I've checked your hemoglobin and your hematocrit. 24 to 36 hours later, it seems to be, you know, okay, you're non-tachycardic, go ahead and do your oral iron in that case. And if it's, oh my gosh, your hemoglobin is 6 and it wasn't drawn over a line, you need blood, at least one unit. And then we can talk about potentially giving you some IV iron. And then it's that catch, guys. This is where that slice comes in. In between that 7 and 8 grams per deciliter, non-bleeding, asymptomatic patient, tanking her up, sending her home, packaged her with her little suitcases full of physiologic iron that she can then incorporate into her reticulocytosis once it goes through its metabolism, you're just doing her a favor. Because she's going to be tired already. And so being a postpartum tired and then iron deficient anemic tired is just not helpful. Well, yikes. I have just been pulled back because I've totally rambled and given a bunch of spoilers of stuff that I'm supposed to be talking about in the future. Sorry. All right. So back to what we're talking about. Let's just review quickly iron. These are great gotcha questions. I mean, pimping questions. I mean, learning questions for our medical students or residents on rounds, all right? Is that still called pimping? So if you guys, we've got plenty of family podcast members international across the world, and I don't want you to get the wrong impression, right? So when you're grilling a medical student in love, of course, I mean, never for humiliation purposes, like on rounds, and, you know, hey, this is the way we learn, right? I mean, we learn by interaction, so sometimes it's okay to ask questions. It's all in the intent. Just to be clear, when I was a medical student and a resident, yeah, that was true pimping. I mean, they wouldn't stop asking questions to a single person until, like, you started having blood coming from your eyes. I mean, it was like, wait a minute, am I crying blood? That's amazing. And then they move on to somebody else. I get that those times may have passed, but there was something to just firing questions at you that was called pimping, okay? So here's a question to ask your registrar, your resident, your intern, your medical student on rounds. Again, out of love, of course, never for humiliation. So ask them, how many grams of elemental iron in general, if in a well-nourished individual or in their body? And then what is the demand that pregnancy places on top of that throughout the duration of pregnancy? So the bodies of otherwise well-nourished individuals contain about 4 to 5 grams of elemental iron. Half of that circulates in red blood cells, right? So you've got around anywhere from 2 to 2.5 grams circulating in RBCs. The remainder is in the bone marrow, liver, and the spleen, right? Bone marrow, liver, and the spleen are 50%, and then red blood cells in circulation is the other 50% of that 4 to 5 grams. Now, during pregnancy, there's a physiological increase. That demand is anywhere from 1,000 to 1,200 milligrams of additional iron needed. And about 2/3 of that are going to go for the mom, okay? So 2/3 go for maternal needs, and 1/3 of that go into the fetal placental unit, okay? So how many grams of elemental iron in a typical person, 4 to 5 grams, you need about 1 gram additional throughout pregnancy. 2/3 of that are for the mom, 1/3 is for the fetal placental unit. However, this need, this 1,000 milligrams, is not equally distributed all throughout pregnancy, because as you would think, there's a lower need in the first trimester, and then it increases in the second, and then obviously again increases in the third trimester. So the highest need is in the third trimester, when there's about 3 up to 7 milligrams per day additional that's needed in the body. There's a nice review on this, on the demands of pregnancy for elemental iron, out of the journal Nutrients that was published in 2017. And of course, I'll put that on our reference list. During pregnancy, this daily need of elemental iron comes out to about 27 milligrams of iron per day. Now, that should be, the majority of that should be from diet, from iron-rich foods. But I don't think McDonald's or Wendy's or Jack in the Box really gives iron supplements in their food. So this is a typical American diet, all right? So 27 milligrams of iron per day is required during pregnancy, ideally from dietary sources. But of course, that's why we need supplementation. And remember, taking iron every day, not helpful. Taking iron 3 times a day, even less. So the best way to work on the absorption channels and the iron transport system in the blood is every other day. We've covered that in past episodes. You got to go back. I'm not going to cover that one here. But those are the quick numbers, right? 4 to 5 grams of elemental iron in the otherwise well-nourished individual. You need about a gram additional during pregnancy, but the need increases throughout gestation. So that's the highest need, about 3 to 7 milligrams per day is in the third trimester. And all that translates to a daily requirement of about 27 milligrams of elemental iron per day. Typically should be coming ideally from dietary sources, but that's why we have supplementation. All right, now here's another clinical pearl, right? Here's another one for the pimping session. What is the amount of iron that's necessary based on someone's blood loss? Ooh, that's good, right? In other words, let me rephrase that. If you have somebody who bleeds PPH, they've got 1,000 mLs blood loss, in general, not counting BMI or height or anything like that, in general, how much milligrams of iron are they down? It's a super quick formula. This has been tossed around through the American Society of Hematology and the American Academy of Blood Banks for several times. So here's a quick way to remember this. It is zero, the need for iron with a blood loss event or PPH is 0.5 milligrams of iron is required to replace every 1 mL of blood loss, right? So it's almost 1-to-1. Does that make sense? So let me say that again. In the case of a bleeding event or like a PPH, the amount of elemental iron that's necessary to replete the loss is 0.5 milligrams of elemental iron per 1 mL of blood loss. So if there's 1,000 mL blood loss, which is the definition of PPH, then the patient would require an additional 500 milligrams of elemental iron to help correct that. Okay, so it's almost 1-to-1. So remember, how much iron is necessary to fill a gap? 0.5 milligrams per every 1 mL of blood loss. By the way, that 0.5 milligrams per mL quick kind of math is nothing new. That came out in 1934. That is in the article, The Iron Content of Whole Blood of Normal Individuals in the Journal of Biological Chemistry, 1934. And that number has been validated several times. Now, remember, I'm not talking about hematocrit and hemoglobin. That's different. I'm talking about elemental iron, okay? The amount of elemental iron per ml of blood loss is 0.5 mLs. In the otherwise normal person, okay? Now, just to be clear, there are formulas that you can actually look up and do to try to figure out the amount of true milligrams of iron per blood loss based on target hemoglobin and the actual hemoglobin and body weight. It's super complicated. Look, if you just remember 0.5 milligrams per 1 ml, you're going to get it in the ballpark almost every time. All right, so that's kind of interesting and irrelevant little trivia. No, it's not irrelevant. I mean, really, it's kind of useful. Plus, if anything, it's kind of a little quinky-dink fact that you need 0.5 milligrams for every 1 ml of blood lost. All right, now that we've covered that, let's talk about IV iron options. We're not talking about the oral stuff. We're not talking about giving blood. As we've mentioned, those two are pretty clear, right? Somebody's postpartum and their appropriately timed hemoglobin is above 9, they're going to be good. Just tell them, hey, take your oral iron, take it with something acidic or vitamin C and do your due diligence there. And if it's less than 6 or at 6, you just need something to function like a person. So we're going to give you blood. And then it's that little middle zone where IV iron has a potential role. Yes, I understand. Yes, there's cost issues. I understand that. However, in the bigger scheme of it, it's much better for the patient. All right. So first of all, IV iron options. There's several derivatives out there. There is iron sucrose. There is a maltose-based product. Of course, there's dextran. There's a variety of different ones, including ferumoxytol, which is used internationally, not so much here in the U.S. There's a gluconate form. fine. There's a variety. There's not predominant evidence that one is any safer or better than the other. They do have some slight differences in how they work in to steady state, some time levels to reach steady state and to go through its metabolism. But it's really more of an academic issue, not really a true clinical issue. Okay, the one that really historically was thrown under the bus was dextran, and a lot of that came from rapid infusions. Okay, so people have kind of that just scared people. We don't use dextran anymore, even though we know that some of that data may have been technique given. But most, like in the U.S., most of it is iron sucrose, which is Venofer. But there is not overwhelming data that one is better than the other, or that one is necessarily safer than the other. Okay, so that's good news. Now, thankfully, the chance of a true anaphylactic reaction is pretty darn small. It's not zero, but I'm going to give you these numbers in a minute because it depends on who you read. The chance of anaphylactic reaction with iron sucrose, now I don't mean fishbane, which we're going to talk about in a minute. Oh my God, my chest is kind of tight. Ooh, my joints are kind of achy. What's happening? That's not a hypersensitivity issue. That's some kind of weird reaction typically given by a histamine flare, right? By mast cell deactivation. That's a fishbane reaction. Even a little bit of flushing, that's okay. Now, if it's true urticaria and they can't breathe and they're hypotensive, that's a hypersensitivity reaction. That's anaphylaxis. Okay, we're going to talk about these different reactions because at the worst, it's anaphylactic, which is very rare. And then you have fishbane, which is a little bit of discomfort, but nothing major, not life-threatening. And then you have limited reactions, which typically involves a single system, like the skin, like flushing, or muscular skeletal, like the joint issue, as long as it's not respiratory. Okay, as long as that single factor is not respiratory, that's called limited. So you have anaphylactic, you have fishbane responses, and then you have, which is not life-threatening, and then you have limited reaction, which is also not life-threatening. But the short of it is, this has been published in JAMA and others, but I like the one from JAMA from 2015 that took a look at the rates or the possibilities of anaphylactic reaction. So with iron sucrose, okay, which that's why people like iron sucrose for Venofer a little bit more than the dextran derivative, is that iron sucrose, the chance of an anaphylactic reaction was about 21 per 100,000. Okay, now that's anaphylactic. Okay, fishbone. Did you like that? Oh my gosh, I said fishbone because I'm hungry. That's fishbane. Fishbane reactions, muscular tightness, a chest tightness. That's much more common, like 1 in 100. Okay, and I'll give you those. I'm going to go into those numbers a little bit more in just a bit, but remember that iron sucrose, according to JAMA 2015, the chance of true anaphylactic reaction with large volume, so look at all the caveats, okay? So anaphylactic reaction with large volume, iron sucrose, and large volume is defined as 1,000 milligrams. That's why typically the typical protocol, guys, for Venofer is about 200 milligrams at a time. Okay, you can give up to 500. You just got to give 200 first, let that sit for a minute, and then give another dose of 200, although most separate that by 24 hours. Okay, so at 1,000 milligrams, and especially with rapid infusion, which is why we don't do that, you got to take time with that, for iron sucrose, 21 per 100,000. But the highest, according to the JAMA 2015 data, the highest rate of anaphylactic reaction was 82 per 100,000 with iron dextran. Okay, so yes, iron dextran, based on the data, is higher than iron sucrose, but clinically, probably in the big scheme of it, doesn't make that much of a difference, especially with the appropriate precautions, which is slow infusion, and with test dosing. Okay, so while iron dextran initially got the thing of test dose, is pretty standard that nobody gets IV iron without a first, about a 15 to 20 ml test dose first to see how it goes. Because if there's going to be a reaction, typically it's going to happen pretty darn fast, right? There's acute reactions that are fast, typically within the first 20 to 30 minutes, and then delayed, which can happen up to days later, and those are pretty darn rare, okay? So iron sucrose at about 21 per 100,000 for anaphylactic reaction, and then iron dextran at about 82 per 100,000. But nonetheless, despite that, because the numbers are still pretty darn small, Remember that according to the data, and even the CDC says, yeah, iron dextran potentially maybe has some issues, but still, based on the data, we can't really say that one is absolutely the best to use compared to something else, more effective than the other one, or necessarily any safer, all right? Now, in general, the way to give parenteral iron is always IV. IM is not the way to go for a variety of other issues, mainly pain and muscle reactions. So this is IV, never IM. As we've already stated, in the U.S., most of the experiences with iron sucrose, which is the branded name of that, is Venofer, not a sponsor. And again, typically that's given at about 200 milligrams, not more than 3 times per week, and the doses should be separated by 24 hours. The reason is, number one, let the body response go down. Second, you want that gated channel and the transport mechanisms to get reset. So you got to hold on. Okay, so you got to wait a minute between doses, typically about 24 hours. Now, there are 2 JAMA articles that have to do with iron infusion reactions. We just talked about the first one. That was in 2015. The first author was Wang, and the title of this publication was Comparative Risk of Anaphylactic Reactions Associated with IV Iron Products. We're going to talk about another one, which ironically is in the same journal, so that's JAMA Network Open, but this one's going to be in 2022, and I'll give you that reference in a minute, okay? I'll give you that extrapolation of the data in a minute. But the one from 2022, the title is Analysis of Adverse Events and Intravenous Iron Infusion Formulations in Adults with and Without Prior Infusion Reactions. So there's 2 JAMA references that we're going to go through here. The first one that we just went through was JAMA 2015. The second one, which we're about to touch on in a minute, comes from JAMA Network Open from 2022, both dealing with infusion reactions after iron products. Thank you for being part of our podcast family. We really are grateful and thankful that you've chosen to take this journey of medical education with us. You're listening to Clinical Pearls. All right, we got to get moving because we got lots to cover. Very quickly, a couple of contraindications to IV iron is pretty much what you think it would be. Prior hypersensitivity to an IV iron-based therapy. If they have anemia that's not caused by iron deficiency, then obviously they don't need it. If they have evidence of iron overload or signs or symptoms or a history of overutilization, then don't give them IV iron. And some of the relative contraindications and definitely some precautionary notes is to be careful to use it in patients with acute infection or sepsis or pneumonia, because that general inflammation is just not going to work. And they're already sick and you don't want to trigger some other kind of anaphylactic reaction if their immune system is already primed. Okay, so that's the catch there. And then lastly, watch it in patients with severe anemia or those that are very prone, if they've got very bad eczema. It's a relative contraindication because of the dermatological side effect that blood, that iron transfusion can give. So those are more on the precaution tales. Just, you know, they're not straight contraindications. They're just used with a lot of caution and then risk-benefit ratio determination on an individual basis, all right? So acute infections, just kind of wait for that to pass and then avoid administering in those with severe, especially a severe uncontrolled refractory asthma and even eczema or severe atopic dermatitis conditions, because that can also trigger a flare. So you got to consider risk-benefit ratio in those cases. Back to some kind of protocols. Remember that we've talked about test dosing in general. You give a small amount, typically about 25 milligrams of a test dose, typically 25 milligrams of the 100 or the 200 initial dose that's given for like Venofer. And that's done over about 15 to 20 minutes. And then you wait. And if there's no adverse events that's done, that's seen typically in over about 20-minute interval, then you can continue with the rest, all right? So the test dose is super easy. It's about 25 milligrams out of the 100 or 200, whatever you're giving, of vetiver, and then you wait for about 15 to 20 minutes. And if they're all clear, then you can go ahead and continue, because most of the reactions will happen in that time. And remember, based on the data, a lot of these reactions happen with rapid infusion. So you never want to just blast this in there. You want to take its time, because that's a quick way to trigger some of these allergic kind of responses. I talked about in the intro about pre-medication, and I kind of spoiled it already, because pre-medication, even though I trained with that, that was out of precaution, but it really wasn't evidence-based, all right? So no, there's no real data that pre-medication with like Tylenol and Benadryl is necessary before IV iron, and it's not necessary before blood products either. Plus, now that we're about to get into fishbane type reactions, a lot of people mistook that as early signs of anaphylaxis, right? So you started an infusion, they're like, oh my gosh, my chest is kind of tight. Like, well, can you breathe? I mean, your O2 sat's like 99%. What else do you feel? Oh, my joints, my shoulder, my elbows are kind of sore. That's a fishbane, non-lethal, non-fatal kind of reaction, right? But likely based on a histamine flare. And so the thought was, well, if it's histamine flare, give it antihistamine. Not necessary, because antihistamines can also cause people to wig out, can also cause some breathing sedation issues, and sometimes a little drop in pressure. So it confuses the picture, okay? So is it dangerous to give Tylenol or Benadryl before IV iron? No, but it's unnecessary, and it may actually confuse the picture. Remember, fishbane reactions can be worked out. You just got to shut off the infusion, let them recover, give them support, make sure it's not progressive. And if it resolves, typically you just hold the infusion for about 5 to 10 minutes or so, and then you can continue. You can give the rest of it at 50% of the infusion rate, all right? So fishbane type reactions, and fishbane is the original describer of these things, which is typically a kind of an allergic response, but not hypersensitivity. Typically, joint or muscular and chest tightness characterizes this. Then you have the hypersensitivity types, right? So remember I said it's helpful to put any kind of transfusion or IV infusion, so whether transfusion or IV infusion reactions into their boxes. So you have acute life-threatening, that's anaphylactic, which involves two or more major systems, mainly respiratory and cardiovascular. Then you have fishbane-like reactions, which we talked about here, which is typically like chest tightness or muscular. And then you have limited, like maybe a little bit of flushing or just the muscular symptoms, okay? So it's good to document these kind of reactions that way. It was a limited reaction, or it was fishbane type, non-progressive, or it was anaphylactic. And it doesn't have to be full-blown anaphylactic, because you have mild hypersensitivity, moderate hypersensitivity, and then true severe, which is anaphylaxis, okay? So let me just walk through this quickly. Fishbane and mild hypersensitivity reactions, you treat the same. You just shut off the infusion, give them about 15 minutes or so to recover, give them some IV fluid, see how they're doing. Don't give Benadryl for this. Okay, you can give oxygen if needed, just for comfort support to maintain their sats, and then see how they go. And if they cool down after about 15 minutes, then you can continue the infusion at 50% of the rate. Remember, slow and steady. That's the answer here. And then after the infusion, you watch them for about an hour. Okay. Now, if it is more moderate of a hypersensitivity reaction, which is not just the rash or itchiness and the chest tightness, but now we're building more blocks, right? We're putting more problems on top of that foundation. So the first layer of blocks is called fishbane. That's non-lethal. And then you have mild reaction. That's more bricks on top of that, which includes things like the itchiness, maybe headaches, some nausea, the facial flushing, the metallic taste. All of that is treated with fishbane. Same, those are all non-lethal. Moderate, that gets people's attention a little bit more, okay? So that's where you have cough, you have maybe some wheezing, a little bit of difficulty breathing, shortness of breath, hypotension or tachycardia. Stop the infusion. That you stop that, you give them IV fluids. For moderate, anything that requires respiratory or blood pressure support, boom, you got to hit them with hydrocortisone. Okay, so give them a corticosteroid like hydrocortisone, typically about 100. You remember, infusion has been turned off, and you don't re-challenge it. Okay, you say, well, that freaked us out a little bit. We're going to stop there, and then we're going to observe you for about 4 hours. If it's anaphylactic, so they have true stridor, they cannot breathe, or they go unconscious, or the worst, they have cardiorespiratory arrest, then yeah, that's the end of it forever, all right? And you do full, you know, rapid response, and they need to be watched, of course, and thankfully they recover very quickly with epinephrine, corticosteroids, as pressors as needed, and IV fluids, but then you watch them for 24 hours, all right? So very quickly, Fishbane reaction. A Fishbane reaction can happen after IV iron. That's typical. It's also possible with blood products. It's just this response to, hey, something is coming in here that's foreign. I'm kind of wigging out a little bit, but it's non-lethal. Typically, that is chest tightness, muscular, or joint. Okay. Mild hypersensitivity reactions is that plus things like itchiness, headache, facial flushing. They can have a little bit of anxiety and the metallic taste. That's treated, again, just like a mild reaction or a Fishbane, with stopping and then continuing the infusion if they calm down. Moderate needs intervention, okay? So moderate issues, anything that's respiratory or hypotensive, that requires stopping it, and they're done with the IV iron. That's it. You do not continue. Do not pass go. And then it requires fluid, oxygen support, and then corticosteroids. And then the last one, of course, is anaphylaxis, which we talked about as rapid response. Before we leave this whole reaction issue, I told you that that second JAMA Network Open publication from 2022 that looked at IV infusion reactions. So we're going to get back to that. Well, here's this data extrapolation from that, all right? Fishbane is much more common than some kind of fatal anaphylactic reaction, thankfully, all right? But it's not that rare either. It's about 1%, right? So about 1 in 100 patients with IV iron administration may have a kind of Fishbane reaction. All right, so everybody clear? So when you give blood products or IV iron, always good to think about it in three boxes. Is this an anaphylactic, life-threatening issue, typically involving two big systems, typically respiratory and cardiovascular? Or is this a mild reaction, like a Fishbane reaction, that's an allergic response but not really life-threatening? And then you've got a limited response, typically one factor only, like facial flushing or muscular, or even a temperature regulation, like a little bit of pyrexia alone, all right? So put those into perspective. Now, that big box, the most worrisome, of course, is anaphylaxis, and remember that that is broken up into mild, moderate, and severe, just as we talked about here. But this is what scared people. This is why people gave Benadryl and Tylenol, including me, all right? I mean, I've told many a resident before all this data changed to do that because, you know, it can't hurt. Well, no, that can't really hurt, but it doesn't really help at all. So that's only useful if it can't hurt and it could possibly help. And it doesn't seem that it helps. Nor does it help with pre-medication for blood products, guys, all right? So again, if that's part of your hospital policy, don't break policy. Just bring that up at the next policy review, because part of that data was published in 2019. Out of a large systematic review and meta-analysis, they actually took a look at pre-medication for the prevention of allergic and febrile non-hemolytic transfusion reactions. So let's give Tylenol and Benadryl. And what they found was, absolutely no different in responses, right? In non-hemolytic related transfusion reactions or febrile reactions, it didn't make any difference at all. So the author stated, quote, "The findings from this systematic review argue against the routine use for pre-transfusion medication. Such practice fails to reduce non-hemolytic transfusion reaction in patients with no prior history of transfusion reaction." The authors go on to say, "The impact of pre-medication on patients with a history of reactions in the past is unclear, and further research is necessary." End quote. Okay. So again, this has been looked at. This came out of a large systematic review and meta-analysis in 2019. The first listed author is Ning, N-I-N-G, and the title was "Pre-Medication for the Prevention of Non-Hemolytic Transfusion Reactions, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis." This was in the journal Transfusion. All right, everyone, we've got to wrap this up because I had no idea it was this long yet again. So the question that we originally asked before we did all this other stuff was, what does the data say for IV iron in the postpartum interval for patients with moderate anemia. What does the data say? And I want to go over two systematic reviews that answer this because these were relatively recent and then we're going to be done, okay? But before I do that, do you remember I said earlier that there was a formula, pretty complicated, take the body weight and then target versus actual hemoglobin, and then you do some math and you do a converter factor to try to figure out how many milligrams of elemental iron there is to the body. I forgot to give you that name because nobody uses it. Super complicated, unless you're a hematologist or nerdy. And I'm super nerdy and I don't use it. I just use the typical 0.5 milligrams of elemental iron per 1 ml of blood loss. That's a good rule of thumb, right? But the formula, if you ever want to catch somebody and ask them, what is the formula to actually calculate the total amount of iron necessary for repletion based on body weight and the actual hemoglobin and their target hemoglobin, what's the name of that formula? Here it is, everybody. It's the Ganzani formula. Yeah. Ganzoni. Ganzani formula. Never have I been at a patient at bedside who's having a postpartum hemorrhage, and I say, hold on, let me get my Ganzani calculator. How about you? Have you done that? If you say yes, liar. Liar. Everyone, as we wrap this up, let's talk about these benefits of IV iron in the moderate anemia group. And if you think, oh, you know, we've known this for a while, this is old news, not that old. This was published out of BMC in Systematic Reviews January 2024. Now, this is not the only systematic review and meta-analysis. There was another one that I'm going to give you in a minute that both basically said the same thing. Yeah, this is pretty legit. Okay, yes, this works. So in this systematic review and meta-analysis from January 2024, the authors took a look at IV iron compared to red blood cell transfusion. And even though the data was, quote, low to moderate, they did find the trend for IV iron winning for better hemoglobin values, better saturation values compared to oral iron. They also showed a significant reduction in fatigue with IV iron compared to the oral formulation, all right? And here it is. And they also took a look at ferritin as well, which is nice because that was a winner there too. Oh, and then listen to this. This is, I thought, was a little weird, but okay. We all worry about IV iron transfusion, right? Transfusion reactions compared to oral, because oral iron is just so safe, right? Yeah, but it makes you feel terrible. In this publication, quote, the direction of effect also favored IV iron for total adverse events with a risk ratio of 0.63. In other words, yeah, it had less adverse side effects than oral iron. Something to consider. Again, this is out of BMC Systematic Reviews, January 2024. This is the last publication we're going to do before we wrap this up. This is the second systematic review and meta-analysis that predates the one from this January 2024. This comes from the Gray Journal, the American Journal of OBGYN, from 2019. The lead author is Sultan. In this study, Sultan and colleagues performed their systematic review of 15 RCTs comparing hemoglobin improvement between women who had oral or IV iron therapy. And as you would guess, it was a win for IV iron. So much so that the lead author said on a separate editorial, quote, current guidelines recommend the use of IV iron therapy if oral therapy fails. Perhaps it is time to have the conversation about whether we should use IV iron as the primary treatment for iron deficiency anemia, end quote. And if you're thinking, wait a minute, that's nice, that's great, but is this iron deficiency anemia for what? For the second trimester, for the third trimester? No, no, no. Because Sultan et al.'s publication, the title was, and the focus was, postpartum anemia. See, the title of the systematic review was oral versus intravenous iron therapy for postpartum anemia, a systematic review and meta-analysis. All right, everyone, I think that pretty much brings us to a wrap. So what have we talked about? We've talked about that gap, right? Those who are super anemic, like in harm's way with a hemoglobin value of 6 or less, oh my God, that's a no-brainer. Offer them blood. Now, I understand that there's some cultural issues and some don't accept blood. That's a separate issue. I'm not getting into that today. Maybe we can talk about that later. But in general, six or below can't maintain homeostasis, okay? It's that gray zone between 7 and 8 that if they're asymptomatic, non-bleeding, or IV iron, is a good rival to oral iron therapy. And there's not one formula that is, without a doubt, better than the others, although there is some safety profiles that favor iron sucrose over the dextran variety, all right? And then lastly, remember that in those who have a hemoglobin value of 9 or more in the appropriately timed hemoglobin and are otherwise asymptomatic, those can do with every other day oral iron therapy. So we've kind of walked through this kind of thought process for postpartum acute blood loss anemia. Of course, the first problem is iron deficiency anemia. That happens during pregnancy. We got to get on top of that because there's a direct tie between antepartum iron deficiency anemia and postpartum hemorrhage. So we covered a lot. And the best part is we've got a whole list of new cool little questions that we can offer on our morning medical student, resident, intern, or registrar quizzing, aka pimping. All right, let's bring it home. All right, podcast family, that brings us to a wrap. As always, we're thankful for you, and we're glad you're part of our podcast community. We'll see you on another episode of Clinical Pearls.